So for the last 1.5 years, my health was very bad. I often was only lying in my room and couldn't meditate a lot. I was very weak, couldn't go to evening meetings, and I got very depressed because I didn't know how to handle when your body is so weak, so you cannot meditate, and your concentration is also very weak. If you read a little bit, and this is too much. How can you practice this when you, I mean, for a short time is no problem, but when you're for a long time, the body is very weak.
Well, when you're like that, then just use awareness, really. Have metta for it. And just investigate it, you know, you're still going to be mindful, and then the unpleasant feelings, the pain, the discomfort, and even your emotional reactions to it of not wanting to meditate, you can't do it, things like this. Just use what's ever present to be aware of it in terms of it's like this, not to make it into, you know, a problem, but to just don't make problems around it. One year I had malaria, you know, and very badly, and I had asked the same question that you just asked to Lumpa Cha. I can't meditate anymore, I'm just too weak and sick. I mean, at Tham Sangpa, I was thinking I was really developing samadhi, and I was really going for it, tooth and nail, and face hand, getting it. And then suddenly, I can't do anything. And then you've got all these views about malaria that you've heard, you know, about people dying, going crazy, because I didn't know what to expect. So Ajahn Chah said, well, now your meditation is malaria. And keep that in mind, just use whatever you're experiencing, you know, good or bad, with this attitude, it's like this, so you're just kind of accepting it. And be patient with the discomforts, physical or mental, that you're going through. You learn a lot from that, you know. I learned more from that than I did from getting samadhi. Because you have to really change your attitude. Where, when I was in the samadhi, but it was me, you know, so based on me trying to get something, you know, trying to get something that I felt I didn't have through reading or what others would tell me. So it was based totally on this illusion of I've got to get samadhi. And then with the malaria, it was more like seeing the reactions I had to the fear I had of going crazy with malaria, or the aversion I had to the physical side of it. And so I just started just observing, and I let go of the mental reactions, because I realized I wasn't going to die. And they gave me some of these chloroquine tablets, you know, to take. In those days they used that. And then I realized that the actual, like malaria, one day you're feeling quite normal, and then you start feeling the oncoming of this fever. You can pick it up very quickly, and you think, here it is, the malaria thing, and then it builds up to a crescendo in a few days, and then it just ceases, and you're like, I'd just be soaking wet, like it, all the water in my body just kind of drenched the mat I was under. And then you got this feeling of kind of cool relief, which was very pleasant. You know, so all the things about malaria weren't all that. Some were pleasant, some weren't. But if you're just fighting against malaria out of ignorance, then you may not notice anything other than you don't. How can I get rid of it? I don't want this. And I had reoccurring fevers for about a year, and then it stopped. But I learned a lot from that. You know, I learned how to deal with illness and physical pain and also fears of, you know, dying of the unknown. And because in America, I never encountered malaria there, but you'd hear stories about GIs coming back from tropical countries, and they, for the rest of their lives, they were had these malaria attacks. And it sounded really awful, you know. And oh, my whole life is going to be, I'm going to have this for the rest of my life. That kind of perception. Not true, you know. It wasn't an obstruction at all. And it just had to change from this personal striving that I was using a lot to get something that I wanted, to more or less accepting the conditions I was experiencing. So when you get like that, you know, I encourage you to try it out, because you'll learn a lot. You know, it's not, these are not obstructions. Even though you might personally regard them as such, but that's another view you create yourself.
Often I have the problem because my feeling of samana getting weak, you know, because I'm only lying there and I not even can copy that, but even in Chani cannot meditate, you know, I can only read a book, you know, it's not samana like, and then I feel depressed because, you know, this is not like what samana is doing, so it's more like touching. Thing is coming, and so this works together.
Yeah, well, you also, you know, this samana life is, doesn't mean you can always be good at everything. Because in Thailand, the word gang is applied, you know, oh, he's really gang, and he does things very quickly and better than the rest, and he kind of holds that up. And so many of the gang Phurong monks disrobed. That didn't last very long. So that's why, you know, have more confidence in your awareness of these things. You know, whatever you're grasping, you feel you're not a very good samana. That's a feeling you create, you know. So you start looking at it not as just trying to suppress the feeling or believe it, but just, no, it is a perception that comes and goes. It's not there all the time. But, you know, you're attached to an ideal of what good samana should be. That's another creation. And then you're sick like that, and you can't do any of those things that good samanas do. And then people have to come and bring you food, and you're only junior monk, and things like this. Then you can feel guilty or worthless. But these are all things to observe. You know, that which observes is not, you know, will help you to see through the illusions you're creating about yourself and your ideals.
Lumpur, we were having some fevers at Pujamgong this year, and we'd heard that there was this dengue fever. We'd heard it was coming up in the hospitals, and a couple of people got it, and it seemed like the symptoms corresponded to that particular pattern of fevers. And then a couple of other people got this other fever, that the symptoms weren't exactly the same, but they were pretty close. And it was really interesting watching the mind kind of like trying to like put it into a box, but not being able to. Like almost, it was like, oh, it would be almost better if it was dengue fever, because then you would know what it was. Even though it's a terrible thing that nobody wants, but all of a sudden you're like, but this unknown thing is worse.
And who makes these names for these? Humans do. You know, they say, that's dengue fever, that's malaria. But the words don't really matter. It's, you know, and then we create a security out of believing in definitions and in words. Like observing yourself, how sometimes things aren't real unless you have a word for them, or you can define them. You know, so I notice this in myself. So much of life, it's moving, it's, you know, this continuous movement and changing this. And words tend to make something more than what it is. So, you know, a word just goes by very quickly. This is dengue fever, or it's not dengue fever. And then you attach to that concept of dengue fever, where actually what you're experiencing is like this, whatever you want to call it. And you don't need a word because you're actually experiencing it. But so many diseases now have no names for them. You know, nobody knows quite what they are. They call them viruses or something, because that's a generic term for what we don't know. And this is like the human condition is, you know, we create this world, a world that we create ourselves and gives us a sense of security. Like, I met people who wanted an identity, no matter if it was a good one or a bad one. So, you know, to say, I'm just a nobody, can be another ego. You know, so, or alcoholics will say, I'm an alcoholic, almost, you know, when you first meet them, I'm an alcoholic. And that's an identity, something to define yourself with, alcoholism or whatever, you know, nationality, class, sexual orientation. Everybody's pinpointing themselves as some kind of, you know, heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual, and then you're identified with race or class or ethnic group. And why do we do this? You know, why do we have to have a definition? Because we don't know ourselves, so we want, even if it's not a very nice, like I'm a nobody, or I'm just an ordinary guy, is still an identity. And or I'm a hopeless case, or I'm no good. You know, you can, the other people talk about themselves like that, or others more like saying, well, I was first in the class, and I was a very highly regarded basketball player, and I'm a film star or a rock singer. and then it's like being a famous person or a movie star, something that gives you an identity of being somebody important. And then within the forces, you know, the milieus that we're living in, how do you see yourself in the sangha? What identity do you hold about yourself? But, you know, you're the one that creates these identities. They aren't absolute, fixed identities sent from above. They're what we create in our own minds. Ajahn Chah, the first year I was with him, he said I should reflect on my own virtues and goodness. He could tell that I'm, my basic character, it tends to be self-critical. I was very much aware of weaknesses and faults and negative things about myself, because I thought that's being honest, you know, I'm honest about myself, you know, I've got this problem with this and that, and a lot of fears and that. But Dr. Cha didn't, I guess he could tell that that was my tendency. So he said, think about your goodness. And so I went back to my kuti and I started trying to think my virtues. And I never thought of myself. Here I was 33 years old or so, and I never thought of myself as virtuous or good. And actually, nothing came up in my mind. And then, if you asked me, well, what are your faults and weaknesses, I could have given you a long list. And I think, why is that? Why do I see the just the negative side of me, because if I was just a neurotic, hopeless mess with all these faults and weaknesses, why would I be living at Wat Bapo, living under Vinaya, keeping a celibacy? You know, why wouldn't I, you know, if I was such a neurotic, screwed up person, why wasn't I back in Berkeley taking all the drugs? This is when the drug scene was wide open, you know. They were having a really good time. And, you know, you could do anything you wanted, and nobody would criticize you for it. Where, you know, in Bapo, very strict, you know, you had to conform, you had to do things according to, and, Boy, I could have left and gone to Berkeley and just led a kind of easy life, but I knew that that's what I didn't want. So that's because I began to admit I really love truth, goodness, and beauty. Otherwise, why would I be a monk? Why would I meditate? Why don't I just, you know, I was in a situation where hedonism was encouraged everywhere. Enjoy the world, enjoy the senses, do whatever you feel like, attitudes. It wasn't that I was prohibited from that, just I could see that it was a hopeless way to live. In the end, you know, I was aware in Berkeley of people that had lived that way for a long time, and they were not. They were rather pathetic, you know. As you get older, it's a kind of ugly way to have to live your life.